court is going to take just a few moments. We're going to remain in place, but reconstitute the panel. And then we'll also wait for the lawyers for the second case to just get settled. And Marshall, you can begin by calling the second case. I'll note for the record that Chief Judge Frisch has substituted in for Judge Jepal J. Harris, and the second matter, please.
Calling A241174, State of Minnesota Respondent versus DeTuan Coppell Allen Appellant.
And I see counsel are here. Please take a few minutes and get settled in. Don't feel rushed at all. I have just a few quick remarks to make. I think everyone's aware that these proceedings are being made available via video conference as they are happening. We are also making an audio recording. And so a couple of my remarks are just to remind you of a few things. So, for instance, that when you approach the podium, of course, I want to make you to make yourself comfortable and have whatever you need, raise or lower the podium, adjust the microphone. But I particularly would like you to make a clear audio record because that's later what is put on our website and also made available to the public. So identify yourself as well as the client you represent before you begin your argument. And please keep an eye on the clock. We really enjoy our conversation with you today. Having said that, it tends to go really quickly. So please go ahead, counsel for appellant, when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Sarah Martin. I represent the appellant, DeTuan Allen, who appeals his conviction for aiding and abetting second-degree intentional murder. This was a deeply flawed trial, and there are multiple issues raised in this. Three issues: sufficiency of the evidence, the prosecutor misstating the law in closing argument, and the jury instruction on expansive liability reflect a fundamental disagreement between the parties on the law of accomplice liability. This same disagreement was addressed in the recent Supreme Court case, State versus Segura. The opinion in that case supports Mr. Allen's argument. That's where I'd like to begin today, but I also want to note that even if this court disagrees with my interpretation and accomplice liability, that Mr. Allen's conviction should still be reversed based upon the remaining errors raised in the, including inflammatory, irrelevant Spriegel evidence, improper opinion testimony, and the erroneous hybrid jury instruction that blended accomplice liability with the elements of the offense. Under Minnesota Statute 60905, Subdivision 1, a person is criminally liable for the acts of another if the person intentionally aids the other in committing the crime. The statute and the case law make clear that the defendant must know the defendant or the accomplice was committing or going to commit a crime, and that he intended his actions to further the commission of that crime. It can't just be any crime. That's the problem in Segura, and it's the problem in this case.
Well, I thought that the only other crime that was suggested, or to the jury at least, was attempted aggravated robbery. Am I wrong about that?
You're correct, Your Honor, that was brought up during closing argument.
Well, the jury was instructed on that with respect to the felony murder.
With respect to the felony murder, which the jury acquitted on, so the jury rejected that theory.
But that makes Segura, as I read it, different, because there was just sort of a random reference to a drug crime without it being tethered to elements of a crime that would have to be proved.
I agree to the extent that the argument on the felony murder was linked to the robbery. But in terms of the second degree intentional murder, the state made very clear its theory throughout trial. And in its opening statement, the prosecutor said that there's no clear motive in this case. Throughout closing argument, the prosecutor repeatedly referred to this was an execution, this was an intentional murder. These three were working together to commit a homicide. Robbery was not the target offense in this case. It was not the charged offense. The only offense that was charged in this case was second-degree intentional murder. So the expansive liability provision really doesn't apply. Under the expansive liability provision, if a person is liable under subdivision 1, they are also liable for any reasonable foreseeable offenses committed in furtherance of the intended crime. The state made very clear here that the intended crime was second-degree intentional murder. There were no other offenses committed in furtherance of second-degree intentional murder. So the subdivision 2 expansive liability does not apply.
What? I mean, it strikes me that there's no real dispute that there is sufficient evidence to sustain a conviction or sustain a reasonable inference that this was an intentional second-degree murder. What are the circumstances proved that support an alternative, your alternative hypothesis?
The circumstances prove that support an alternative hypothesis that Mr. Allen did not intend his acts to further a second-degree intentional murder. First of all, the fact that there is no camera in the alley, so we don't know what happened.
Well, that's not a circumstance proved. I mean, what happened? What are the things that were proved during the trial that support an alternative rational inference?
Mr. Allen was back at the car well before Mr. Kinnard and Mr. Travis appeared on the camera, and that very close in time to the shots being fired.
Isn't there wasn't it about a 15-second delay between the time that Mr. Allen left the alley and Kinnard
and Travis?
Yes. Then they left the alley. Just 15 seconds, right?
There is a 15-second span between Mr. Allen driving away in the vehicle or appearing right next to the vehicle.
Uh-huh.
Investigator Keating explained that he would have been out of the alley several seconds before that occurred, though. And if you watch the videos, and I don't know if the court has viewed the videos, but Mr. Allen comes from the far side of the house. Mr. Kinnard and Mr. Travis come from the close side of the house. So he would have been out of the alley well before Mr. Kinnard and Mr. Travis appeared.
Okay, so we've got that circumstance proved. What else? What other circumstance proved?
The other circumstance, that's the main circumstance proved, that supports a reasonable inference.
And what does it support a reasonable inference of?
That he was not in the alley at the time that the shots occurred. And that he did not know that Mr. Kinnard was going to kill A.B., and that he did not intend his actions or presence to further that crime.
And I understand that was argued to the jury, but we also have Investigator Keating's testimony that he was in the alley at the time the shots were fired. So why don't we credit that choice of the jury? Why don't we credit that fact as a choice, or that testimony as a fact that the jury chose to accept?
Well, that gets to another issue in the case, is whether Investigator Keating should have testified to that at all.
Right. Let's put that question aside. But I mean, why is it? Why shouldn't we accept his testimony on that fact?
Because we have the videos. Investigator Keating testified that it was his opinion that Mr. Allen was in the alley. But when asked, where on the videos can we point to what time the shots were fired and what time Mr. Allen emerges from the alley, Investigator Keating says, "I don't know." So it was very clear. This was just his opinion. It was his opinion that Mr. Allen was involved, but that's not a circumstance proved.
Let me ask you this. What role, if any, does the Spriegel evidence play? Is it part of the circumstances proved, or is it something else?
Again, that gets to another issue.
Assuming we were to decide no abuse of discretion in allowing the Spriegel evidence, so say it's in, what role does it play, if any, in terms of our assessment of the circumstances proved?
I don't think it has any bearing on the circumstances proved because it's irrelevant. And was likely used as propensity evidence in this case. And I'm happy to talk about the Spriegel The Spriegel evidence is only admissible if it is relevant to one of the stated purposes, like motive, intent, or common scheme or plan. And it's only relevant to those proper purposes if it's similar to the charged offense. The court admitted this evidence, reasoning it's the same scheme or plan if you rob a person at gunpoint. But robbery at gunpoint was not alleged. So the state made very clear they were not alleging felony murder in this case. They were not alleging murder or a death in the course of a robbery. The charged offense was second-degree intentional murder. The state's theory that this was an execution. The Spriegel evidence was a kidnapping. It was aggravated robbery. It involved electronic transfers of funds. They are very different.
But it involved two of the same actors. It was similar locations within 18 days. Guns included, stolen cars involved. I mean, it seems to me there's a lot in common between the two.
Well, there was no stolen car involved in this case. There was no involving the victim. Is that what you're...
Right, but okay. I'm just saying they don't have to have precise similarity to meet the common scheme and plan analysis under Spriegel, do you?
According to the Minnesota Supreme Court cases, Ness and Clark, for example, yes, they need to be very similar. They need to be markedly similar. In both Ness and Clark, the offenses were very similar to the charged offenses, and they weren't similar enough. It was error to admit them.
Can I just draw you back to the circumstances proved? Are there any circumstances that were proved that are inconsistent with guilt?
I don't know that there is a specific inference proof that's inconsistent. The fact that Mr. Kinnard's DNA was not on the weapon Mr. Kinnard's DNA was the only DNA on the weapon, and that undercuts the state theory that the three men, or the state's sort of hypothesis that the three men had possibly passed the gun around, and all three of them took part.
But your client had gloves on, right? I mean, that's evident in the video.
I don't know that that was a circumstance proved in this case. But to the extent that there was none of his DNA, Kinnard's DNA was the only one on the weapon, that would be inconsistent with guilt. But again, we need to look at whether the circumstances proved are consistent with a reasonable hypothesis other than guilt. And it is in this case, given the fact that Mr. Allen was back at the car well before the other two. It's possible that he was not in the alley at the time. And given the fact that this is...
The problem I have with that, counsel, is that we're taking that fact in isolation and not considering that Mr. Allen's actions that are otherwise circumstances proof. For example, he led the way into the alley. He led everybody into the alley after him. He drove there. He did a U-turn. He parked the car. I mean, it seems like there's some reason why they're there, and there's some reason why they're there with the victim, with this particular victim. And I'm trying to get at what is that reason other than the intentional second-degree murder? What is that other reason? And I'm having trouble from these circumstances proved piecing together what is the alternative hypothesis.
I think that if what the state had charged and what he had been convicted of was felony murder in the course of a robbery, mm-hmm. that the circumstances proved would be sufficient to prove that because it appears that that's what they were doing. There's no...
Does it? I mean, they didn't take anything from him.
That's certainly
possible. Which is probably why he was acquitted of that charge.
That's entirely possible. And then that leads to the question of what other crime was the jury relying on if they were relying on this expansive liability instruction that was provided to the jury. Segura makes clear that you can't convict based on a belief that the defendant intended to assist in some unspecified nefarious conduct. It's not enough that there's some other crime. So that gets to this problem with the instruction on expansive liability in the case and why that likely confused the jury. Mr. Allen objected to the expansive liability instruction because there was no other crime alleged. A target offense in this case was second-degree intentional murder. Mr. Allen's attorney argued that he feared that the jury would find Mr. Allen guilty of intentional murder based upon evidence that would only support a felony murder conviction. And that's likely what happened in this case. It's likely that they convicted based upon some unknown crime because they rejected robbery. So how did the jury assess foreseeability under prong two? How is this court supposed to assess foreseeability under prong two if there is no other target offense specified? The law is very clear that the jury should only be instructed on relevant portions of the law. The expansive liability portion was not relevant in this case and should not have been provided to the jury.
And so is it your position that that, and if I agree, if the court were to agree with that, aren't we still left with strong circumstances prove that your client entered that alley with the intent of murdering the victim here or to aid and abet his fellow
certainly
compatriot
and I wanna,
in doing so?
I want to be clear here. If this court believes that the evidence is sufficient to find Mr. Allen guilty, we still have to address all of the other errors in the case. And the problem with the misconduct, misstating the law in closing, and the problem with the expansive liability is that the jury may have been confused and convicted Mr. Allen, even though it didn't believe that the state proved liability under Subdivision 1 or under Subdivision 2. So Mr. Allen asks this court to reverse his conviction because the evidence was insufficient, but in the alternative to reverse and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Anna Light, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney, and I represent Respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. There is no other reasonable hypothesis other than guilt from the circumstances proved in this case under both Subdivision 1 or Subdivision 2 of the accomplice liability statute. One of the critical questions, excuse me, in this case involves expansive liability under Subdivision 2 of the statute. Appellant's narrow view of this statute is directly refuted by Minnesota Supreme Court precedent, as explained in the case McAllister, as well as this court's cases, such as the non-precedential case in State v. White that I cite in my brief.
Well, I understand you don't have to necessarily have charged another crime, but what is the evidence of any other crime?
Sure.
Other than intentional murder, which obviously is a serious crime. But what
yes.
What justified any instruction on expansive liability?
So the state presented two alternative theories of guilt. One, that they were there intending to commit murder. But second, that they were there to attempt aggravated robbery. And in the course of that, caused a murder.
But what evidence was submitted on that?
Well, I mean, I think
on the second point.
Sure. I mean, there we can go to the necessity of the Spriegel evidence and that the marked similarity there with the actors, the location, the time, the approach of a stranger with a armed firearm. To kind of explain why these actors were here, how they had gathered in the apartment in Minneapolis ahead of time. They had driven together. They spotted a single man walking alone at night in a dark, quiet residential neighborhood. They made a U-turn, turned off their headlights, gathered around the corner out of view of the victim, and then the appellant leading the way, beckoning for the accomplices to follow when he turned into the dark alleyway. If it wasn't murder, the logical assumption would be that they were there to rob him.
Do you get there without the Spriegel evidence?
I mean, I think just from the sense of why else would they be there, and this isn't necessarily circumstances proved, but the fact that there was no relationship between the perpetrators and the victim, there was no motive for why they would intentionally murder.
That goes to the other theory that it was a hit, essentially.
Right, which we, you know, and there isn't evidence of motive there. So then looking at why would they all be there, why would they target this person walking alone at night? The Spriegel was necessary and relevant and probative.
Is it part of the circumstances proved for us and when we're assessing sufficiency of the evidence?
I think it is, because I think it was admitted within the discretion of the trial court. It wasn't erroneously admitted. It's evidence there that the jury can view. The jury was certainly instructed that it can't find appellant guilty of this offense based on his conduct in committing the other crime, but it can go to the circumstances.
I'm looking at the prosecutor's closing argument, and there's references to the Spriegel evidence. That's what I do. That's what I like to do. I mean, it seems to me that was used as propensity evidence, wasn't it?
Well, and no, it was used to establish the close association between appellant and Kinnert. It was used to establish that appellant's intent to be the leader of these crimes, to have a firearm involved, to organize and orchestrate the approach of a victim who is alone, to go to attempt an aggravated robbery. So that's what the evidence was probative for, that's what it was relevant and material for, and that's what it was used for, not to convict him of aiding and abetting this intentional murder.
So how do you respond to appellant's argument that the Spriegel admission was error in light of the fact that we have two very different offenses here? I mean, you've described the method, the specific events, as being similar. Mm-hmm. The argument of appellant's counsel is that, yes, but these are very different offenses charged. Aggravated robbery wasn't charged here.
And that's true. Aggravated robbery was not charged here, but there are marked similarities in, again, the actors, that it was Kinnert and appellant, that there was a firearm, that they approached a single man victim, male victim, it's probative for the fact that in determining the requisite state of mind for accomplice liability, one of the things to look at is the close association between the accomplices and the appellant. And here, the Spriegel evidence goes directly to that, and then to intending to further the commission of a crime in this case. It shows that that Kinnard wasn't acting alone, that he had no idea what was going to happen, that appellant had orchestrated and led similar crimes previously. So I do want to push back a little bit from opposing counsel's argument regarding getting to liability under subdivision 2 and the expansive liability. We do have a fundamental disagreement, and I believe that the correct analysis, as stated in McAllister, is that the appellant needed to be there intending to aid a crime. It does not need to be intentional murder. And then the murder was committed in furtherance of that crime, the intended crime, the target crime, and then that the murder was reasonably foreseeable by appellant as a probable consequence of the intended crime. And that is also what Segura says. Segura says there needs to be a specified target crime. It does not need to be charged. It does not need to be, it needs to be specified and known, but it was here.
Committed, too. And we don't have an aggravated robbery or an attempted aggravated robbery here, do we?
Well, I believe we have an attempted aggravated robbery in the fact they took a substantial step by targeting this individual, by waiting till he turned down a dark alley where there were no cameras, ambushing him in that alley. We don't know what happened in that alley, but that's
They didn't take anything, and he had plenty of things of value on him.
He had about $60 in cash.
And he had electronics and other things of value.
True, yes.
And nothing was taken.
True. There is a case, if I can look at my notes, I made a note of an attempted robbery. Atkins, from Minnesota Supreme Court in 1996, the defendant and accomplice entered a hotel with the intent to rob the clerk of the hotel. Quickly turned into assaulting and murdering the clerk. They ran away, did not steal anything. And so there wasn't a completed robbery, but they were convicted of aiding and abetting the intentional murder because the intended crime being an aggravated robbery. And so even though it's not completed, it doesn't mean that it wasn't intended or that it wasn't the target, the reason that they were there, and the reason that he wanted his presence and actions to further the commission of that crime. Something had happened in that alley, which, you know, tragically resulted in Mr. Becker's death, and where it quickly turned into the intentional murder with 8 gunshots fired, 6 hitting him, and the cadence of those gunshots as well prove the intentionality of the murder.
What do we make of the circumstance prove that your esteemed colleague is focusing on, and that is there are 3 shots. Mr. Allen is running out of the alley ahead of the shooter and the other accomplice or the other person who was present, and there are 4 additional or 5 additional shots. What do we make of the fact that there's a hasty retreat by Mr. Allen, which might be indicative of his surprise that a gun was used in the commission of this offense?
Well, I think if he had hastily run from the gunshots, jumped in the car, and fled alone, abandoning his accomplices, that would be one thing, and that would show.
They're arguing that he did just that. He got in the car and he beat it, and then he did come back and pick him up, but he was out of there as soon as it happened.
And I think the circumstances proved negate that as a reasonable inference, because quickly he drives away, and then he quickly is seen on surveillance cameras, headlights off, prowling around the neighborhood, going through alleys, going down side streets, looking for his accomplices. He's the getaway driver. He's the driver that drove them there. He's the first one to lead them toward the victim. He's beckoning them to come. He's the first one to turn down the alley. And then he's the first one to leave the alley, to jump in the car, to go back to his role as the driver. He then drives around the neighborhood slowly with his headlights off, to pick up his accomplices and flee with them, which is another a part that you can look at for requisite state of mind.
Is there a rational inference to be drawn from the fact that he gets in the car and leaves, as opposed to he gets in the car, turns it on, waits the extra 15 seconds for the for Mr. Kennard and the other gentleman to show up, and then leaves with everybody in the car right at that time?
Well, I think, you know, there in some of the surveillance cameras video, you can see some lights turning on in some of the houses in the neighborhood. Yeah. So I think they were aware that they had just, you know, 8 gunshots had gone off in this quiet neighborhood close to midnight. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to get caught. He didn't want to get seen. He didn't want the license plate written down. I mean, we're not in his head. So these are,
but
you know, inferences.
There. He was still there, prowling
right,
around. Right,
moving,
yeah,
to find his accomplices. You know, I think also notable when they get back to Kinnard's apartment in Minneapolis, they had all shed layers of their clothes when they walk back in and are seen on surveillance camera entering the building, which again goes to state of mind and guilt.
So I want to follow up. The chief asked a question about, you know, the significance of the hasty retreat, and you've talked about that. How about the testimony from the investigator that, in fact, it's possible that Mr. Allen wasn't even in that alley at the time the first shot was fired, that just based on the timing from the surveillance and how the investigator has pieced together all this, which in some ways seems largely uncontested, the timing of shots and where people were and mm-hmm. when they were captured on video, that he wasn't even there.
And I think the investigator was asked a yes or no question based on the fact that the 8 gunshots take 15 seconds, and that there's a 15-second delay between when Mr. Allen is seen and then his accomplices coming out. And so in the phrasing of the question, I think he answered a yes or no question, and then he went on to explain why that wasn't what he believed happened based on the timing of the surveillance video.
But is it a reasonable inference when you have the investigator, I think, a couple times saying, yes, do you agree there's sufficient time that Mr. Allen could have left before the gunshots were fired? Answer, I agree with the math we did.
So I don't believe that's the math as it actually plays out. I mean, I agree with the 15 seconds.
I'm just saying the testimony, yeah. Wouldn't that be something, and that's from a state witness, so it would be part of the circumstances proved. Wouldn't that support a reasonable inference that, in fact, Mr. Allen had no intention that anyone was going to be killed back there? He probably had an intention to do some other nefarious behavior, but not murder. And that when he saw a gun coming out, he ran.
Again, when you look at all of the case law and how you determine his requisite state of mind from the circumstances proved, and you're looking at his presence at the scene of the crime, and he was present. Whether or not he doesn't need to be the one to shoot the gun. He doesn't need to actually be standing next to his accomplice as the shots are fired. But he's present. He brings them there. He leads the way. He has a close association with these accomplices. There's numerous communications between Kinnard and appellant in the days preceding. They're together that whole afternoon into the evening. They go together. They leave together. I believe they're looking at the fact that he runs to the alley, gets in the car, and then patrols the neighborhood for his accomplices to pick them up and bring them back to Kinnard's apartment shows lack of objection and surprise, and that any inference other than that is unreasonable based on the totality of the circumstances. And I think to the Chief Judge's point, we can't look at these circumstances in isolation, that we need to look at in totality what is going on here and what did he know at the time.
Could you reasonably infer from all of these circumstances that Mr. Allen was surprised, didn't expect, planned to do something bad but not shoot and kill somebody, but still felt that he should come back and help his colleagues who did something he didn't expect flee the scene?
Yes, and so two points quickly. I see my time is running out, but one.
Your time, counsel, you can answer.
His intent, so that would go in one. In one aspect, that would go to his guilt under subdivision 2 and the expansive liability. He was there with the intent to commit a crime. The murder was committed in furtherance of that crime, and it was reasonably foreseeable. So he is guilty under subdivision 2. But alternatively, in a State v. Smith from this court in 2017, that case made clear that knowledge of the crime can be formed during the commission of the crime. So as long as in an aiding and abetting case, as long as the defendant is intentionally aiding after he's aware that the crime is going on, he's guilty. He doesn't need to know ahead of time that they are planning a murder, because that would transform this into a premeditated murder, which it wasn't, and we're not arguing that. So Smith, that I cite in my brief, goes to the point that he didn't need to know ahead of time, but once he knew that that's what was happening, he continued to aid and wanted his presence and actions to further the commission of that crime. If there are no additional questions.
Yeah, I don't see any other questions for the panel. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You may be seated. And we're ready for you for rebuttal.
I'd like to address the last point that the state made regarding intent forming throughout the course of an offense. And I would agree that intent can change throughout the course of a crime. For example, in McAllister, which the state relies on for this point, the defendant participated in a robbery. That robbery included a brutal beating, shooting, and so the court determined that even if his intent was not an intentional murder or premeditated murder initially, that throughout the course of the crime, he formed that intent. And that is the same thing in Adkins. The shots were fired immediately upon entering the hotel. And again, that was a felony murder case. So the corollary in this case would have been if Mr. Allen, if there was proof that Mr. Allen remained in the alley and continued to aid once Mr. Kinnard formed the intent to kill. That's what is missing in this case. There is no evidence that Mr. Allen intended to aid and abet an intentional second-degree murder. The state argues that you can find liability under 609.5 subdivisions 1 or 2, but that's not correct. These are not separate bases for liability. Under the statute and under all of the case law interpreting the statute, you must first find the defendant liable for an identified target offense. That offense doesn't have to be charged, but it needs to be clear. In every single case where the court has upheld a conviction under expansive liability, the target offense was clear. Segura makes that clear. Anyalobi makes that clear. So you're liable under subdivision 2 for offenses that were reasonably foreseeable as a probable consequence of the target offense. Again, in this case, the target offense as charged and as argued at trial was second-degree intentional murder.
So, Counsel, how do you respond to respondent's argument that the target offense not charged was attempted aggravated robbery?
That was not addressed at trial. It was not the state's theory. The state's theory in opening statement was there's no clear motive here. They didn't identify a target offense. The state's theory in closing argument was that this was an execution. This was an intentional murder. These three worked together to commit a homicide. When the state was discussing the expansive liability provision, which, again, I don't think should have been given in this case, the state provided robbery as a possibility. Say he's there to commit a robbery, and the murder occurs in the commission of the robbery. But this was not something that was fleshed out through testimony. It was not fleshed out as a theory at trial, and it certainly wasn't the charge. Unless there are further questions.
I don't see anything from the panel. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Our thanks to the lawyers in this case. The matter is very well briefed and well argued. It is now submitted to this court for a decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory timeline. Thank you again.